So hello and welcome to another episode of Open Studio. I'm your host, Martina Flora, and today I'm thrilled to have James Edmondson joining me. James is a type designer based in San Jose, California, so he woke up very early to be on the show today. He studied graphic design at California College of Arts and graduated from the Royal Academy of Arts Type Media Program in The Hague, Netherlands. With his team at Ono Type Co., he creates custom and retail typefaces. Hi, James. Thank you for coming on the show today. How are you doing?
I'm well, Martina, and thank you for having me on the show. And I love how you say the Royal Academy of Art in The Hague, Netherlands, like you also didn't go there, but you did.
Oh, yeah. That is true. That is true. So we are not going to criticize our teachers and classmates on this show, but we might do it when we are out of the air, right? So,
just Peter Verhoel. Just Peter. That's it.
That's it. So, James, for our listeners who might be new to the world of type design, could you please explain what type design is and what is the one thing that sets it apart from other letter making disciplines?
You know, I've been thinking recently about how similar everything is actually instead of what kind of sets them apart. But type design is just the craft of making typefaces, and that could be anything just from a set of numbers to an entire fully fleshed out thing that supports a million different languages and has a ton of features in it. I think what sets it apart from something like lettering is that you have an interchangeable format and you don't know as a designer how the user is going to then take your drawings and mix them up and put them in a different order that you didn't think about, you know, sometimes. I think what sets it apart from a lot of different 2D design is that it's only in black and white, and you kind of can present things in color, show specimens in color or something like that. But as a designer, we're really only working in black and white, which is something that I love and is a good way of kind of filtering out some amount of bullshit for me. It's just like really focusing on the problem. There's color fonts and stuff like that too. But I think most of the time when people are using a font, they're expecting to put the color in themselves. And even when I'm working also as a lettering artist doing a logo or something like that, I'll tell the art director, like, hey, I can really only get this as far as a black and white drawing, and it's up to you to do everything else and see how it fits in the system and stuff like that. But type design for me is also a kind of a spiritual practice, which sounds very silly, kind of like embarrassing to admit, but really it's kind of a safe place for me and kind of a place I go to relax and unwind also, which is weird. And I'm not a super spiritual person, but to me it is just a little bit beyond a craft or a job because of the emotional well-being that it gives.
That's interesting because, I mean, it's no longer a hobby for you. It's already your job, and you have, you know, turned it into a company now with your Type Foundry. So
yeah, it still is a hobby though, you know, because there are still a lot of typefaces that I do that really generate like no money. Sometimes like the majority of work that we do, sometimes it feels like it doesn't really move the needle in our revenue. So it's both, I think, for me.
Yeah. So I want to dive deeper into that aspect of your business and your practice as a type designer later on. I want to know a little bit how you build your business and also how do you strike that perfect balance between, you know, doing something that really lights you up and you really like, but at the same time finding a way of making income with it and, you know, finding that perfect balance between fun and also profitable. But before we dive into that, I want to start by understanding how do you come into type design? Because I know that you initially studied graphic design, then you fell out of love from graphic design, and then you found type design, and you initially approached letter design through lettering. So how did you become interested in type design, and what also led you to professionally start a Type Foundry with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just my only option at having a job or a career. I had nothing else and no other backup plan. But originally I came to it, I think there's just, for a lot of us, you're probably the same way, just sort of an innate attraction to letters for some reason. Hmm. I think it might be a combination of the kind of craft counterpart along with a system, you know. You really don't have to be that creative, you know, because the system is already there. Like, we already have an idea of what the letters are supposed to look like and how to read
them.
And
then you have to fill it, right?
And then you're just making up a filter. So I really appreciate how not creative it is as a craft. Illustrators really amaze me because they truly create something from nothing. And type designers are tracing. And most of the time we're just tracing, you know, like kind of slightly changing ideas or riffing on something that's been done before. Kind of like a musician playing a cover or like a jazz musician doing standards or something. That's a lot of what type design is. But originally I come to it because I was a little kid that wanted to draw letters, and I did that at various stages of my life. You know, looking back on it, it's really easy to post-rationalize or kind of justify how this thing sort of magically fell into my lap. But my dad got me a set of calligraphy pens when I was young, and that was a very pivotal moment for me, I think, because it came with instructions, you know, something to trace.
And how come your dad gave you a set of calligraphy tools? Because it's not the kind of gift you give to a kid.
No, totally. I mean, they were like the felt tip kind, you know, they weren't the real legit like speedball or anything, but it was just like the brand was Sanford. So it was something that they sold at Staples, which was the big office supply company. Yeah. And my dad was pretty, he was a teacher. He taught English at our high school, and he was pretty indulgent with anything related to school. And he would also get us like magazine subscriptions. And as kids, you know, that was before the internet is what it is now. And so I got, you know, like whatever magazine subscription. I remember my brother also, we were indulged with this stuff. School supplies totally fell into that. So when August came around or people were going back to school, we would get to go and get our binders and our stuff for our binders. And that just felt like such a fun kind of thing, because my parents weren't real indulgent in other, of course, we got Christmas presents, birthday presents, and stuff like that. But when we grew up, when I was really young, we were broke. Like, my dad was a public school teacher, and my mom stayed at home. And I have five older brothers. So when I was born, my parents were like,
no money left.
There was no money. Yeah. We got money later after my parents' parents, my grandparents passed away. So I'm not saying like there's no generational wealth in our family. There totally is. But when I was really little, we were broke, and my parents were getting, you know, ridiculed by their friends and family. Like, why do you keep having kids? Like, you guys gotta, this is like getting irresponsible here. You should really stop having kids. But my mom really wanted a girl, and so they kept on having kids. Anyways, when I grew up, I kind of saw the transition. I wasn't even, you know, aware of it at the time, of course. Mm-hmm. But yeah, talking to my parents about this later, like, we didn't do a lot of the things that, you know, families with a lot of money do or whatever. Mm. I asked my parents, like, God, how did you go out to eat with six kids? And they're like, we didn't go to restaurants. What are you talking about? Like, that's that we ate at home. Like, that's just not, it wasn't a problem because we didn't do it, you know? But yeah, now it's a different thing. So anyways, I came into it through school supplies, basically.
Yeah.
And I was really fond of just kind of playing with it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know why it just kind of stayed a thing for me. But I also wasn't like taking art classes or even in high school really doing too much with like art. But there was a Photoshop, like graphic design sort of class my senior year that I took. That was awesome and also a really pivotal moment. And I was not at all the best student in the class, but, you know, I learned Photoshop when I was like 16 or 17. Like, looking back on it, that was very useful to get some sort of understanding of those tools. But I didn't have the confidence to go to an art school. I felt like that was for kids that were just way better than I was.
You know? But you did go to art school, didn't you?
Yeah, it came later. Yeah. So I went to a different school first, Cal Poly, and studied graphic communication in San Luis Obispo, California. And I was like, wow, sure would be awesome to study graphic design, but I'm just not that cool and I'll just never be. And, you know, so I'll do this thing that's kind of tangentially related, but is not as creative. And then it just wasn't working for me. You know, I wasn't making friends at that school. I was having a terrible time. And this is like college when you're supposed to be having fun and stuff. And I wasn't, and I was hating it, and girls weren't talking to me. I was just, like, struggling, you know? And so I took an internship with my brother in San Francisco who had a startup, and he needed, like, a web designer and someone to work on, like, PowerPoint presentations and stuff like that. So I went up, and I lived with him in San Francisco for a summer, and I never went back to my other college. So I kind of dropped out of college for a while. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know how detailed you want me to go in this story, Marta, but I'm giving you the full thing.
Sure. I just wonder, like, how, you know, how in the world you came into the idea of like, hey, I'm going to sign up for this 1 year type design course, and then I'm going to start a business in type design.
Oh yeah.
Just drawing letter forms all day long.
Yeah, that came later. I mean, it was basically like I met this girl at a bar, and I had a fake ID to even get into this bar. And we started dating, and that relationship went absolutely nowhere. But she had a sister who was studying interior design at CCA. And I was talking to her. She's like, oh, you seem really interested in graphic design. You should really look at the program at CCA because it's really great. I see the students doing cool work there. And I was like, okay. And I just signed up for the school. Like, it wasn't a real tricky school to get into, you know? It was kind of like, if you're willing to pay the absolutely ridiculous tuition, then you can come.
And you finally did. Okay. So so now I wonder, you know, for those that are listening, because our listeners are illustrators, and as you said, your heroes, kind of lettering artists, graphic designers as well. And I would love for them to hear from you. How, you know, what is the process of creating a typeface? What is your typical process when you start a typeface? Because I think it's pretty different, or I don't know if you think that it's pretty different, but for many that have never designed a typeface, I think it would be interesting to hear how is the process of creating a typeface from concept to have it ready to be published, right? What are the steps? If you can break them down in steps, what are the steps that you go through to finally publish a typeface on your Foundry?
Yeah, I think the weird thing about it is it starts way earlier than you might think, because even before you have a concept, you have kind of just like your own taste, you know, and the stuff that you love to see or whenever you, I think my memory is kind of mostly visual, you know, like I don't remember stuff I'm supposed to, but I'll remember like how the logo looks on this thing, you know. I will forget appointments.
That's what your wife says for sure.
Oh, you.
That's what your wife.
Yeah, we should bring her into the room here and just kind of get her thoughts on that, because my brain is seriously stunted in many, many ways. But my memory does kind of prioritize like 2D design for some reason. So it begins like with whatever project, you know, it could begin like the first inkling I have of wanting to do something can come years before actually putting pen to paper and thinking about how we would actually do it. So it begins with what I want to say and what's kind of been done and all these things I'm just kind of keeping track of in my head. And then eventually, you know, I'll start drawing. And now I draw on the computer and draw by hand both. It doesn't really matter to me which comes first, because it's kind of like a ping pong sort of thing where I go from one to the other and back again. But it just starts with a handful of letters, you know, the letters that are hopefully going to be indicative of what the typeface is trying to do, and letters that are trying to encapsulate a lot of it. So it's very common to hear type designers say like, oh, we like to start with a capital H and a capital O, you know, to see what straights are doing, to see what rounds are doing, and then a lowercase n and a lowercase o. And that's why our Foundry name is Ono. But we also like to get in letters that are going to like have a lot of diverse shapes in them, like a capital R, for instance, has the diagonal, straight, and a round. And, you know, if you're doing something with serifs or with contrast, that can be a really good thing to sort of figure out. And then you just kind of have a checklist of all these parameters that you're trying to figure out and nail down and make a very concrete decision on, you know, because you don't want to have too many ideas, too many things changing. Like if you decide what your descender on your lowercase p is going to be, you don't want to then change that when it comes time to do the q and the y and the g, you know. So it just begins with many, many things up in the air, and you're just kind of grabbing like these balloons floating away, and you're kind of grabbing them and anchoring them into a kind of singular position. And if that position is very simple and very easy to articulate, I think that generally makes for a strong project. But it could be absolutely anything, you know. There's so much variety that you can explore, and that still has yet to be explored, even though there's hundreds of thousands of typefaces. So as you're going along and figuring this stuff out, you know, you go from the letters to the numbers to the punctuation and all these different characters that are not in my native language, and just filling out the character set. But that's assuming you're doing like a single style thing. You know, if you're doing something with multiple styles, it's of course, you know, a slower process, because you just have more ground to cover in what our former teacher, Eric Van Blocklin, refers to as the design space, which is one of my favorite words. But yeah, how things transition from a light to a bold or a narrow to a wide or any anything can be in a design space.
And so I just wrote down a few steps, which is, you know, it starts with a trigger, which could be anything that inspires you, which is in your library of letter forms, in your mind, in your memory. And then you sit down to draw a handful of letters, which are like the test letters or those test words where you just kind of test the concept, play with the shapes. Then you expand that into an alphabet. And for those that are listening, when you start expanding this into an alphabet, you start also feeling like kind of like the font editor, which looks kind of like a grid. And this is what you were mentioning before, which is great about letter design and type design, which all fits within a system and that gives you a structure. So I love that moment where you go from a word to kind of fitting or expanding the alphabet into like the slots of a font editor. And then you start expanding that into weights and widths, which is the design space you were just talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Did I get it right?
I mean, it sounds good to me. I love how you are asking questions and like explaining this, like you don't know the answers to, which is great. You're so good at like putting yourself in the position of the listener, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. Because also I have to say that if anything, I feel that I approach the world of letter design from like the hardest side, which is type design. Type design is tough. What you just mentioned before, that the fact that for you is very pleasing to work in black and white and to have this kind of like clean workspace where you don't get distracted by colors and textures and all that stuff. I think for the normal common human being, it's not their, you know, it's not, it's not what every creative person will prefer. And this is why I try to place myself out of that picture, because right now my world, it has more to do with, you know, shapes and colors and textures and like telling stories. And I still appreciate that environment of like working black and white and kind of being, as you said, away from distractions when you sit down to work. At the same time, it's the one thing that I found really tough from the time I was working in a type foundry. So I worked here when I first came to Berlin. I worked for a year for type designer Lucas de Groot. And I learned a lot in that experience, but at the same time, I also learned that this is not the work I want to do.
Working for someone like Lucas, like that's a very specific, hardcore, like environment. Like when I talk to people that have gone through there, or that sort of the production side of the business, you know, I talked to Daria Petrova about it, and she said, yeah, that we were designing different diacritics depending on whether there was overshoot or no overshoot. And I'm like, oh my God, like this is getting insane. You know, might do different diacritics for lowercase to uppercase or something like that. But that is another level of nuance that, to me, for the work that we do, we just have diminishing returns for the amount of, you know, work going into it. At a certain point, you know, we have to run this like a business and say, okay, this is working. but yeah, that really surprised me. So I could understand how a young designer going and working there would be like, okay, fuck, get me out of here.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's an interesting segue to what I wanted to ask next, which is I think that the foundry that you run, Ono Type Co., has a style that really stands out in the world of type design, and your collection of typefaces is not what everybody will picture when thinking of a type foundry. You know, when you think of a type foundry, you think of more of a, you know, a business that creates fonts for texts or for a screen. But when you look at your font collection, it's very playful and very expressive. So I would love for you to share with our listeners how did you find and develop that niche? Because you really have to go into first you have to find that interest in the work you do. So you certainly have a certain focus and a certain world of inspiration that inspires your work. But at the same time, you need to also develop a niche and make it profitable. So first I want to ask you, how do you come about developing that niche? What were the things that you paid attention to? And also, what were those pivotal moments or events where you said, okay, this is the direction, this is where we are going to double down on with this Thai foundry?
Yeah, thank you, first of all. I think there are some kind words in what you said. It's nothing new, you know. There's always a way of doing some, no matter how boring the thing is, there's always an interesting way of doing it. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter how corny or how lame, there's always a cool way of doing something. That's an idea that I kind of come back to all the time. But yeah, it's nothing new. You know, I was very inspired by House Industries before I got into design school, even. I got their 10-year book and just really obsessed over it for a little while. Mm-hmm. And before House Industries, you know, there were people like Emma Gray, or I guess that's kind of around the same time. Before Emma Gray, there were people like Dan Solo, who would collect really obscure, interesting, rare typefaces and provide them for photo typesetting. Before that, there was Hamilton and all the crazy stuff going on in American wood type, and it just goes back and further and further and further and further. There's always going to be some kind of need for interesting typefaces or things that grab your attention in a kind of new or a different sort of way. It's just that'll always be there. But what I've learned over time is those things, they can only sell so much, you know? We found that it really, really helps us to have other things in our library that are more usable and can be used over and over, and a little less timely, you know? A little bit slower to come in and out of typographic fashion. So whereas before, all we were doing was the first thing. And I feel like we kind of hit a ceiling of how successful we could be doing that. And now we're trying to get to a point where, my dream is that no matter who you are, what kind of designer you are, you can come to our website and find something that you really love. You know, I think that would be ideal. And hopefully some things that you really hate, you know, I want there to be, to be both things in there for everyone. So yeah, it's also when I was starting out and thinking about running a foundry, I would go to something like fonts.com or some monotype property and just think how lame and terrible everything looked and how there was this discrepancy, right, between everything I see in the world, all the hand-painted signage, or all the things that really move me, or I just I love and I'm drawn in by and I want to take a picture of. And there'd be that stuff in the real physical world. And at that time, this is 2010 or something like that. And then going to fonts.com and seeing, oh, there is none of that here, you know? And I don't want to shit on monotype too much here. I'll do it a little bit. But they're catering to a totally different audience. You know, they're catering to mega businesses that are going to shell out $1 million a year to license Helvetica for the 10 billionth time, whatever. You know, it's a totally different business. But at the time, I was just thinking, God, why does this not look like this? Or why is there none of this fun, unique energy in fonts being presented for commercial use? And I think now, you know, that was like over 10 years ago or whatever, but now it's sort of shifted and there's a ton of typographic diversity online pretty much everywhere you go.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is a good thing in the end. And it's something that I hope gets other like young designers excited about, you know?
Yeah. So I was wondering, you just mentioned that, that, you know, you feel that at some point you reach the ceiling in terms of how much you can sell by doing fonts that are really like out of the norm. Like your library is full of those kinds of fonts that are really unique, playful, interesting. And I wonder, and you mentioned that now you have incorporated other kind of typefaces that kind of expand possibilities of also of making a profit with your library of fonts, right? Yeah. So I wonder how are these typefaces that you have incorporated recently are different from the other typefaces? What are some of the features, the way they look? How do you think about them when you start designing a font for your library that you feel or think that is going to be, that is going to sell better?
I guess one way of thinking about it is just like the kind of optical size it's designed for a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And so what is optical size? Yeah, this is the size for which it's intended to be used. When type was metal, type could only be used at the size that it was cast, you know, at the physical size that it actually was. And then when type became scalable, first with phototype and then with digital type, you could then use any font at any size and you could shrink down display fonts. They look jacked up. And you could blow up text fonts and that would also look jacked up, but maybe jacked up was good in some cases or whatever. So anyways, we just have to be careful about that now and kind of say what they are and kind of market them for what they are and show them how they're meant, how we kind of envision them to be used. Of course, we love it when things start getting used in ways that we didn't predict and stuff. But, yeah, I think it's just we're starting to think about drawing things for smaller sizes now. And that's a different challenge, but very much the same too, you know? I sometimes say, like, anyone can draw a single letter, and it's much more difficult to draw a word. Then it's much more difficult to draw a phrase, to letter a phrase or something, you know? Then it's a paragraph, right? And that is a different challenge. And then after a paragraph, it's a page. And then from a page, it's a book. Then a book to a volume of books or an entire website or something. Then an encyclopedia or, you know, it just goes on and on. And these things kind of become. So you're designing for smaller sizes and for longer form reading. And some things change and some things don't really change, to be honest. And that's kind of what I've figured out over the years is it's still the same. I still like doing it. You know, I don't have a problem working on one versus the other. I still can find a flow state and it still feels like a safe place for me that I enjoy, whether I'm working on something that, okay, maybe looks a little bit more boring versus something that looks really exciting. I still like it.
Because I think it's also great that you enjoy the work you do. And at the same time, running a company, you need to also make sure that you make ends meet and you support your family and the people working in it. So I I read in your bio that you, in the bio on your website, which is, by the way, really fun, that for why you treated Oh No Type Co as an art project, and when your wife got pregnant, you started thinking a little bit more about, okay, how can I make this, because you were barely making any money, so you started thinking, okay, how can I make this a profitable business? So I believe that this is one of the things you started doing, creating typefaces that are, you know, drawing things for smaller sizes and creating typefaces that are more marketable and easier to sell in a way. But I wonder what were other shifts that that you did from that phase, from turning your foundry into a profitable business, which now has employees and you know, it has a full-fledged library of typefaces. So I would love to hear, first, how did you make that transition? What other things were involved in this transition? And also, I would love to listen to specific things, like certain strategies or actions that you put into place so that you can make this transformation of turning that art project into a profitable business.
Yeah, well, we've tried a lot of things that haven't worked at all. we have sold a lot of merch, you know, hats and shirts and stuff like that, and posters, tried to make money off that. Never really worked for us. I think it's still something that we'll continue on doing in some form of another or another, but it's not going to be to make money, because it just doesn't make money for us. You know, we got our own podcast. We interview type designers on our podcast, Oh No Radio. And that's more or less a failure too. I think it's fun to do and I like doing it. But does it do the thing that I really hoped it would do, which is to draw a ton more attention to the foundry and get more people using our fonts? I don't know. It's hard to measure, but I don't really think it is. We've also launched a school recently. We started doing this in the pandemic, putting up educational stuff on Instagram. And over the years, that kind of transformed into our like Oh No Type School, we call it, where we sell courses and stuff like that. And that's actually doing okay for us right now. And more people are signing up. And that's great. You know, we like education. It's always been a part of my kind of creative practice in one way or another. So we've tried all sorts of stuff that has not worked, by and large has failed. But the one thing that we have tried that has worked is doing typefaces with more longevity. And it's basically our typeface, obviously, in Degular so far. Our typeface Swear and Retail, I also try to do that same thing with, and they don't perform quite as well as the others. But yeah, experimenting with different ways of, you know, diversifying our income, however you want to say that. It sounds so like corny and lame to say it that way, but really it is what we're trying to do. That those things have mostly failed. We keep trying them and we'll always try them, but the amount of failures to successes, you know, that ratio is always going to be like a 10 to 1 ratio. And that's just the nature of running a business, I guess.
Yeah. And I think for most of people, I think, you know, a business is really a lot about trial and error, and some things that work for you may not work for me. And, you know, before we were coming on the show, we were talking about having kids and, you know, all the work that it involves, like having a family and, you know, taking care of them. And there's a lot of things that is more work than enjoyment. And of course there's enjoyment, but you know, the ratio is always, very unbalanced, right?
Oh yeah, there's absolutely zero balance, and I'm happy to admit that finding balance, like I hope no one is listening to this conversation thinking that I found it or am anywhere close to it. My entire life just feels like chaos right now. I cannot overstate the impact that having kids has had on the business. It has completely changed the nature of how I think about absolutely everything in regards to what we're doing, how we're doing it, whether or not we bring people on, stuff like how we treat our employees and what sort of healthcare and benefits we give. Like, it has all been just completely shattered thanks to having kids. And, you know, that's just one life choice that I made that at the time I wasn't really thinking about how it would turn everything upside down for us. But, you know, things are still working and we're still here. You know, we've been in business for a little over 8 years now, and that's not quite enough time to see a full economic ebb and flow just yet. But we're getting closer and closer to that. So yeah, I have no balance. There is never a moment where I'm like, yep, got it figured out now. Like, everything's going to be good forever. There's none of that. And that's the trade-off of having your own business, is like, I love that I don't waste time. Like, I love that I'm never stuck in a meeting that I don't want to be in. Like, that does not happen to me. I love that I have no commute and I can work from home. Like, there are so many things that I appreciate so much of the control that we have. But the trade-off is that I'm obsessed with this thing and I'm thinking about it all the time. And it's not super healthy all the time. And there's not a lot of balance.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's about choosing which kind of problems you want to have. And that's about it. It's, you still have, you know, things to worry about, things that don't work, you know, problems you have to solve. It's about choosing which kind of problem you want to solve and you'd rather solve. But definitely it's also a lot of like trial and error. Like, also raising kids is a trial and error.
I'm screwing up my kids. Are you wondering, constantly, like, every day in different ways? And we'll just have to wait and see in what ways I screw them up.
Okay, so I'm gonna recap what I was just asking, which is, you just mentioned your team, and I know that at some point you started growing your team. I know Jamie, which was one of my students, and I was really proud to see her, you know, coming in your company, doing work that she really loves. And I was wondering, how was that process first of expanding your team, and especially for someone doing the work you do, which is so distinct and so personal, how was for you delegating that part of the work, if you ever did delegate it, the creative part of the work? Because I know that for me, as I started delegating work to a designer, it was challenging because I thought, well, this is, you know, if I'm delegating the creative work, then where am I? You know, where is my my contribution? And also, is he or she gonna do the things exactly like I want them to be done? So I wonder how the process of creating or expanding your team was, and specifically when it comes to the creative work.
Yeah, it was a very enlightening experience, and something that I think helped me grow quite a bit. Finding Jamie and Lynn was just a total godsend. So Jamie Otelsberg now does customer service and font production work for us. And Lynn Barber does a lot of the client related stuff and is in all of our kind of client meetings and does a lot of like project management and invoicing for different sorts of licensing things and stuff like that. And I found them both at the same time because I put out a thing on our Instagram saying, like, I need help in this department. And I thought it was like just customer service stuff because I was getting a ton of emails and I don't want to be emailing, you know, like really, I don't want to email, period. If I could just wipe email off my calendar entirely, I would.
Oh, yeah.
So anyways, because we had some kind of a following on Instagram, I can't remember what it was exactly at that point. But we had been telling the world, or I had been telling the world, this is who we are. This is what we like to do, you know, over and over for a few years at that point. And so when the time came to ask for help, it was great that people already understood that. They kind of got us already. And some of the people that I was interviewing for the like first customer service or kind of like studio admin job, they were like, oh, you know, I could do it. I do it at a, you know, unrelated business or whatever. And when I talked to Jamie and Lynn, they're like, yes, I understand exactly what you need. And Jamie had experience in a type foundry and, or Lynn had experience in a type foundry and Jamie was, as you know, just taking every workshop in and around type design and lettering out there, period. So there was just a real understanding of what fonts are, what type design is, and there was like a respect and appreciation for it as a craft. And I think also for what we do. And so it was a very, very easy thing to kind of choose the right people and to get them coming to us, which I was very surprised by. The act of delegation first started with just, you know, giving Jamie customer service emails and saying, like, here's how I would respond to this. And you can take my response and copy paste it. You can write your own, you know, but do this job the way that you think it should be done, you know, not the way that I think it should be done. And what I learned very quickly is that Jamie is so much better at talking to customers than I am. And Lynn is so much better at talking to clients than I am. It is just, I should not be doing these things. This should not be a part of my day at all, you know, because I'm a designer. Like, that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. I remember when I was interviewing Jamie, I asked her about like how she kind of learns new processes or kind of design systems. And she's like, oh, yeah, I'll just kind of figure out how you do it. Take notes on how you do it. And then I'll make a template for how to do it in the future. And I was like, that's a great idea. Like, I don't know why I never thought about making all these sorts of documents or systems or spreadsheets or whatever that systematize the work and can be reused over and over. Her brain just works so much differently, so much better than mine does with regards to that stuff. So the process of delegating that stuff, easy, because I didn't want to do it in the first place. It was just like an immediate godsend. The process of designing, of delegating design work, that was a lot harder because I realized I have all these opinions about every single aspect of it. And you're in the tricky position of calling it Studio Martina Flor, you know?
Oh, yeah,
like this
I know.
Is like your name. When it's a company name and not James Edmondson Fonts, I like that it's a little bit removed. Like, it definitely feels like my baby and stuff like that, which is kind of cringy to say, but it sort of does. But I have a little bit of license or a little bit of leeway there to be like, okay, this is now a collaboration, and every single thing in here isn't going to be exactly the way I would do it. But maybe it would be better. Over time, I realized that, you know, Jamie was doing certain things better. And she had kind of more patience for the nitty gritty stuff that I didn't really want to be doing anymore. But yeah, I realize I have opinions about absolutely everything, how accents get placed, you know, where they fall horizontally, you know, what they look like, how they relate to each other, what's a problem, what's not a problem, if letters overlap, can they touch, can they not touch, can something have negative side bearings, and like it just gets more and more granular to the point where it's like insane. But then when I hired Colin, which came like 2 years later, a year and a half later or something like that, I quickly learned that Colin was a lot better than I am at pretty much everything. But I do the first part of a project, I think, faster. That's my one narrow advantage over Colin Ford, I'm talking about, who's now like our kind of type director. And he manages the heavier projects that we get into. And he's just better. Yeah, just straight up.
Yeah, and I think the process you went through is so interesting, because at some point, I love what you said about, hey, I'm a designer. That's what gets me out of bed every morning. And this is what I should be doing, right? And, you know, starting a business involves a lot of other things. And I think that I feel that a mistake that many freelancers do, or many creative entrepreneurs do, is that they miss this part of like, okay, I want to start this business. I want to bootstrap this business. And initially I would do everything, but they miss this part of getting to a point where they start delegating, right? And I think that's the, you know, that's where kind of like a lot of things unlock, where you really are working on your genius zone, on what wakes you up in the morning, and when you start getting help in all the things where you're not great, and where other people can be a lot better and a lot more beneficial for your business, the business that you initially started, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't do it soon enough.
Yeah,
because they think like, oh, if I'm getting help, then can I afford that or whatever?
Absolutely.
And they don't realize that you can pay someone for 2 hours a month and just kind of like, there's so many people working very, very, very part-time jobs.
Absolutely.
That are faster and better and eager to do it and enjoy the work. Most importantly, like,
yeah,
Jamie enjoys like the organizational part of it, and Lynn enjoys talking to clients and being in those meetings. And it's hard for me to wrap my head around that, because I'm stupid and I think that people only like the things that I also like, which is just fundamentally not true.
Yeah, and also I think that oftentimes there's this myth that when you hire, you need to hire an expert. And oftentimes it's the other way around. You need to hire someone, or at least in my experience, it was always like hiring someone that has the right attitude and the attitude towards learning the work and doing it well. I remember that I always tell this story, that my first hire was actually my babysitter. So she was taking care of my kids at that time, and she was I noticed that she was really organized and really respectful. So I thought I offer her the job of taking care of the paperwork in my business, and that took a lot of workload out of my down my shoulders. And she worked for me for almost 4 years, and she didn't have any expertise in paperwork and administrative right. work, but she learned it, and she had the attitude towards the work, which was the right one for the type of job. So
totally.
Oftentimes I think there's this myth of like, I need to hire an expert. I need to pay them a lot of money because they have been in the business and doing this for a long time. And oftentimes it's rather the opposite. It's like asking the people that is around you, your followers, your community, your family, maybe. Yeah. So that's a big one, like starting to delegate, and finding the right people, no? So James, I want you to imagine that I am a lettering designer, and I know I'm asking for a lot. So I want you to imagine that I'm a lettering designer. I'm one of our listeners. So I'm a lettering designer or an illustrator or a graphic designer that has no clue whatsoever about type design. I want to start getting into type design. What do I do? Where do I start? James, this is my last question to you before I jump into a little game that we do at the end of each episode. So imagine I'm a lettering designer, I'm an illustrator, I'm a graphic designer who has never been involved with type design. So I want to start getting into type design. What do I do? Where do I start?
You know, we actually have a blog post on our website called Getting Started in Type and Lettering that outlines exactly, but I'll give you the cliff notes here first, which is, to first of all, just pay attention to it in the world and photograph everything that you like and save all those photographs or whatever in a special place where you can go and retrieve them later. And then the other thing is to draw every day. And one way to do that, which we also learned in school, is type cookers, where you go to a website, which is typecooker.com, and it'll spit out a recipe for you to draw something. And there's different stages for how hard you want to make it.
Inspired on that, we created a similar tool, which is called Lettering Maker. It's lettering maker.com. Yeah. So, which is like also like sort of a recipe, but yeah.
Yeah. But the point is to draw every day and to have something on your desk that's just a notebook or a blank sheet of paper where you can doodle things, different ideas. And you can just do that as long as you want. If you want to go into the computer eventually, you know, we also now have a free course on I'll send you the URLs for all this stuff, but it's an intro to RoboFont class. That's the app that we use for making fonts. RoboFont is a fantastic tool that I really, really love. But it's kind of hard to learn at the beginning. So this course is taught by Colin Ford, who will kind of walk you through all the kind of technical aspects for just getting started. But I think the thing that I want to stress for anyone that's interested in dipping a toe into it is to have an overinflated sense of how important it is. And so a great way to do that is to have a buddy or a community in it so that you can share things with and kind of share knowledge with or show stuff you're working on to a friend. You know, if you're just completely alone in it, it can be really hard. So that's a problem we were trying to solve with Ono Type School. And the idea that we had for it is to make a Discord server where people can share work and get free critiques and stuff like that. So for our paid courses, that's something that we invite you to for people that sign up for a lettering class or an intro to type design class or something like that. But yeah, to have a buddy and a community is huge. So like, you don't have to worry about the perfect instructional book or the perfect pen or the perfect kind of paper or the perfect way of drawing on an iPad or whatever it is. Like, that stuff will all come in time. The important thing is to just enjoy it and do a tiny bit of it every day if you can, and to gradually figure out your taste. You know, I think that's kind of our job, is to really, really zero in on the stuff that moves us the most.
That sounds great. And I wanted to give our listeners the link to your Ono Type School, which is school.onotype.co. You can tell that we come from the same school, because funnily, I recently shared a free guide, which everyone can download on my website, martinaflor.com/guide, which is also answers this question of how do I get started with lettering? And I wrote down the exact same things. Like, first, make it your focus, pay attention to it, take photos of the things that interest you. And number two, draw every day, no matter how pretty it looks, how sloppy it looks, just get used to draw every day. So James, to wrap up our episode, I want to play a little game. The game is called Finish the Sentence. Have you ever played it?
No, but I think I could guess what it might be.
So I basically start a sentence and you complete it. Are you ready?
Yes.
I could never get bored of...
type design.
I'm a little embarrassed by the fact that I know so little about...
taxes.
If I wouldn't be doing this for a living, I would be...
a graphic designer.
I'm always chosen first when it comes to...
nothing.
Right now is the perfect time to...
eat lunch.
Amazing. So thank you, James, for coming on the show today. Where can people find you?
Onotype.co or Onotype.co on Instagram and TikTok.
Amazing. So I'm going to add all of this to our show notes so that listeners can find you. Thank you so much again for coming on the show today, James.
Martina, thank you. Thank you for being you. Thank you for doing all that you do. And it's totally an honor to be here. And I remember the last time I saw you in real life was in Berlin in 2014. So it's been like 10 years, I feel like. But
oh my God, we're gonna have wrinkles and everything when we meet again.
Yeah, and hopefully teenage children or adult children.
Absolutely. So thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. See you on the next episode of Open Studio. Bye-bye. So this is it. I hope you loved this episode. You can find me, the host of the show, on social networks at Martina Flor on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you have a question or comments, go to martinaflor.com/podcast, where you can see previous episodes, find show notes, and send voice memos with your comments and questions. You can also watch these episodes on YouTube. Just go to martinaflor.com/YouTube to find them. You can, of course, listen to all our episodes on your favorite podcast platform. If you loved this episode, subscribe to this podcast. And if you leave us a review, it will help others find us. Thank you all for listening and see you in the next episode of Martina Flor's Open Studio. Bye-bye.